You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hi, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 117. In today's episode, we're going to learn about the 64 parishes that comprise the state of Louisiana. We'll learn why we have parishes and not counties. You'll hear interesting stories, history, and some facts about Louisiana, all through the lens of our parishes and geography. And I'll provide you with a tool to explore New Orleans and all of Louisiana from wherever you are. The last episode was about how to experience New Orleans in the middle of this pandemic. Whether you're here in the city or many miles away, that episode has something for you. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I hope you'll find some ways to enjoy New Orleans, even during this difficult time. Today's episode is sponsored by Lizwood Realty. The most frequent questions I get are about moving to New Orleans. If you're ready to make the move, you need a good realtor, and that's where Lizwood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Lizwood Realty help you find the right place. They can help whether you plan to rent or purchase. Look, New Orleans is a terrific city, but choosing the neighborhood that's the best fit can be overwhelming. She makes the process fun and easy. So reach out to Liz and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. Several members of our community have done just that, and they're thrilled with their new homes. You will be too. The other thing that sets Liz apart is what she does after she helps you find a home. She does a really great job at building community and helping people get connected with others in their new area. So again, when you're ready, just reach out to Liz and let her help you make New Orleans a home. I'll put a link in the show notes to an article Liz wrote recently called Moving to New Orleans and Why Sometimes Renting is the Best First Choice. Today's show is also sponsored by our Patreon supporters. If you love this podcast, the Facebook group, and the work I'm doing, please consider becoming a monthly supporter. Find out more at beyondbourbonst.com/Patreon. We'll have a link in the show notes too. A few dollars a month really helps me continue to share my lens in New Orleans with you. And if you pledge $10 or more per month, we'll mention you on the show, like Dean Wyatt and Melissa Walker, two of our newest supporters. Thanks, Dean and Melissa. All right. To help us explore the 64 parishes that comprise Louisiana, I wanted a travel partner, someone who shares a passion for telling the unusual stories about Louisiana and her inhabitants, and someone who cares about where we've been and where we're headed as a state. To that end, I'm joined by a former guest who's now the editor-in-chief of 64 Parishes magazine, Aaron Greenwald. Welcome to the show, Aaron. How are you?
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me. I'm good.
It's good to have you back. It's been about 2 years since you were on with me, believe it or not. And you had curated an exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection all about the founding of Louisiana. And so since then, you have moved a couple times, but now you're at the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. So tell us a little bit about that. What is LEH and what is the magazine that you run?
The Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities is the state council affiliated with the National Endowment for the Humanities. So every state and territory has its own state or territorial council. And we do a lot of the same work that the National Endowment for the Humanities does. We grant monies for funding of exhibitions and public programs tied to literature, history, culture, archaeology, all of the fun things that make up the humanities. 64 Parishes is a fairly new brand for us. It launched in the fall of 2018. Following an almost 30-year history with its predecessor, Louisiana Cultural Vistas magazine.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about this offline before. The rebranding is really great. And it feels to me that 64 Parishes as a publication now really dive, it makes the stories personal, whether it's the history or the people or trends. I know you guys had an article and have a second part coming up about early African-American newspapers and their impact on trying to make cultural change, for instance.
That's right. That's coming up in the fall issue. And you're right. You know, Louisiana Cultural Vistas, it debuted in 1990. And in 2018, it still felt like it was in the 1990s. So it had a lot of good content, but it kind of craved an updating. So rather than simply do some design work to try to freshen it up, we reimagined what we really wanted a magazine that's the quarterly publication all about Louisiana to be. And we were very fortunate to work with some great minds who came up with this idea of 64 parishes. And the title really is what we try to live up to. As you might imagine, New Orleanians like to talk about themselves and people like to hear about New Orleans, but the state of Louisiana has an awful lot to offer here in the city of New Orleans, but also beyond, well into the other parishes, whether it's in the northwest corner of the state or along the coast in the southwest. There are a lot of things to talk about, a lot of particularly interesting stories. And I think you're right. What we've tried to do is make it our mission to tell these stories, whether they deal with major events in Louisiana history or with the everyday lives of people who are caught up in various times in the past.
There are certainly a lot of articles about names and places that most people probably know, but there are just as many, if not more, about maybe forgotten or lesser known things about the state, again, whether it's geography or architecture or people. So let's kind of start with why we have parishes and not counties.
Well, it actually traces its history to the fact that we were a colonial possession, first of France, and then of Spain, and then briefly back to France for a very short period of time. Throughout the course of the 18th century and then into the early years, the 19th, prior to the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, the French and the Spanish were monarchical forms of government. They didn't require voting districts, for example. They organized their geographic locations around the core of an institution that was very powerful and very present in the lives of the colonists, and that's the Catholic Church. So our parishes, or paroisses, which is what it was in French, derived from the Catholic ecclesiastical designation that organizes a district that is where the parishioners, or the people in the church, are living.
And so many of the things we know about the past come from the Catholic Church. So that makes sense and part of what makes us unique.
That's right. And, you know, after the Louisiana Purchase, when the Americans came in, they did attempt to impose, and they did impose briefly, the designation county. So when the Orleans Territory was organized in 1805, there was a designation of counties that was created. They kept parishes as a type of organizing system as well, but counties were created. They existed from about 1805 to 1845, and there was overlap in the usage between county and parish. In 1807, the Americans did say, okay, we'll let you have your parishes, and they divvied up the state into 19 different parishes. Of course, many of those have since been subdivided into other parishes. But when you look at the original 19, you see the relationship to the Catholic Church. There are six of the original parishes that are named for saints, places like St. Bernard and St. Charles, St. John the Baptist, St. Landry. You also have Assumption and Ascension parishes. Those are two of the other original 19 parishes. And the two terms were used not interchangeably, but at the same time until the Constitution of 1845, when for once and for all, the term parish became our local governing jurisdiction in the way that counties are outside of Louisiana.
It makes sense, too, when you talk about the parishes, the original parishes named after saints, they are most, if not all, not far from New Orleans, right?
That's right. Right, that's true, except the exception is, of course, and there's always an exception, even if New Orleans likes to think of itself as the exception. The exception is Natchitoches. Natchitoches is in north central Louisiana and is actually older than New Orleans. Natchitoches is formed in 1714, 4 years before New Orleans. So Natchitoches Parish was one of the original 19. And like Natchitoches, there were other parishes that were named after either after indigenous communities in Louisiana or after indigenous words for things like Plaquemines. Plaquemines Parish is the Attakapa word for persimmon, for example. So you see a lot of Indian names, and you also see names that conjure a certain landmark, whether it's a fork in the river, La Fourche Parish, or if it's Rapides Parish. Rapides is, you know, the rapids. This is the Red River. This is where Alexandria, the city of Alexandria in central Louisiana, is based. So the parish designations have a couple of different sources from that original group of 19.
The chronology, right? So you have the Catholic influence in the various parts that you describe. Lots of parish names are Indian names or are related to Indians. And then you see some that now, through today's lens, pop back up, things like Jackson. And you have Lincoln, of course. You have several that were, my guess is, just based on those, they were named later. And in some cases now, through the lens of the Black Lives Matter movement and just general public emphasis on civil rights and reimagining, some of those are going to come back up for discussion. Some of those were almost certainly named at a time with a certain reason, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, it's funny that you should mention this, because when I was thinking about our talk today, I was going through and thinking about the different time periods where multiple parishes came online. And two groups of parishes struck me as really significant. And I was surprised I hadn't noticed this before, as reflective of broader political events that were happening in the Reconstruction era between 1868 and 1877. For example, you had Cameron, East Carroll, Grant, Lincoln, Vernon, Webster, and West Carroll parishes added. These are all Reconstruction era parishes that either honor Unionists or honor American Revolutionary Declaration of Independence signers. And there's a clear reason why there is this embrace during the Reconstruction era of Unionist names. The converse of that is that in 1912, kind of at the height of what we know is the Lost Cause movement, this is the movement of former Confederates and wives of Confederates and daughters of Confederates to reimagine and recreate the world of the antebellum South as this kind of romanticized place and separate out the causes of the Civil War from slavery. During the Lost Cause is when you see a lot of these monuments that have been the subject of hot debate and, in fact, protests in the past several years. Those monuments were often created during this early 20th century time period. And in 1912, no coincidence, Allen, Beauregard, and Jefferson Davis parishes were created. Allen is a Civil War officer, of course. P.G.T. Beauregard, whose statue was brought down in New Orleans in 2017, and Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, whose statue was also brought down in New Orleans in 2017. It's interesting to think about this. And in fact, I asked Richard Campanella, who you've had on the show and who people love. Rich is one of our regular columnists. He writes a column called The Geographer Space in 64 Parishes. And I've asked him to do a column next year on this question of broader political movements impacting parish naming.
As you're mentioning that, I'm looking at a map. Beauregard, Allen, Jefferson Davis Parish are all almost straight along I-10, right at the or right near the border of Texas, right? And then some of the ones you mentioned earlier during Reconstruction are tend to be, for the most part, they're further north and up towards both the edges of Mississippi and Arkansas. So I can just visualize sort of the map changing as Richard is talking or as you're reading it to see that. But it is, it's interesting. Again, you just sort of growing up here, you just take the names for granted. And then I think it's one of the things that makes it fascinating beyond New Orleans is that you can see so much history just by reading the names and trying to place them in context. You mentioned Richard, and that's, you all have an amazing cadre of writers that write for your contribute to 64 parishes. And of course, he loves geography and history kind of set against that geography and against time. But do you all have a regular sort of cast of authors that write, or do they come and go, or a little bit of both?
We have both, actually. So our regular columns are typically written by the same set of folks. So we have a regular column on geography that's Rich. We do a column called Lost Lit by Ryan Fertel, which is a really fantastic column that where he takes lesser known titles, usually fiction, not always, but usually fictional novels from years past, and he digs them back up and he analyzes them in the context of his life and his experiences. And it's always really good reading. We also have Sound Advice, which for many years was authored by Ben Sandmel and is now shared by Allison Pensterstock, both of whom are very well-respected national publication level authors who write about music and music cultures here in Louisiana. We've just added Jessica B. Harris as our Foodways contributor. She'll be a semi-regular contributor to our Foodways column. The column had been dormant for a while, and we brought it back with the debut of 64 Parishes because, as you know, the one thing you can count on people wanting to talk about here is food. And there's lots to say. So we've brought that back and it's been very successful. For our other areas of the magazine, we have some writers who appear fairly regularly. It's only a quarterly, so it only comes out four times a year. But we also very much look for new voices. We like to develop new voices. We do take pitches or submission ideas. And then sometimes we go out and we say, okay, we really want to do a story on this. So who can we find who is best placed to do that? Whether it's someone who is a professional humanities scholar with a PhD or somebody like John Wirt, who for many, many years was the culture writer for The Advocate, who's going to be the best person to tell that story for our audiences?
You talk about food and two things jump out. Well, one, people in the know may recognize the name Fertel. Ruth Fertel, of course, was the longtime owner and co-founder of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. And so that lineage in the food industry is not accidental. But I think exploring Louisiana, of course, we love to talk about and brag on our food in New Orleans, but there is such a difference of food culture as you leave New Orleans, right? And you head to Acadiana and the Cajun food, but then up in the corner up at Natchitoches with meat pies and the influences of forests and culture there. And there's a pretty diverse palette, I think, as you go across the state, both north, south, and east, west.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you think about some place like Zwali, Louisiana, which is up in the northwestern corner of the state. They're famous for their tamales, and that is a direct lineage of the Hispanic heritage. That's an area that went back and forth between Spain and ultimately the United States before it was settled as the western boundary of the state in 1819. So we have everything from tamales to stuffed shrimp to fried catfish. And, you know, we had, you mentioned Ryan Fertel. you know, Ryan is the grandson of Ruth Bertel, but he doesn't want to be, and nor should he be, exclusively known as a food writer. He is an amazing food writer, but he also is a historian. He has a PhD in history. So he writes our Lost Lit column, but I did convince him for the spring issue to do a full story on Evangeline Made bread, which here in New Orleans is more typically known as Bunny Bread. Those are two brands that were for many, many years linked. They're no longer owned by a Louisiana company, but we were able to get him to do a story. And then, you know, we've done, we're going to have a story on frog gigging next year in central Louisiana in Avoyelles Parish. So we have a lot to cover. And fortunately, most of it is incredibly interesting, and we are very, very fortunate to have writers who are able to write for a general audience and bring their deep researched understanding of a subject to our readers in a form that they can understand. This is not an academic journal. This is a general audience magazine.
So even when you get a current story, you tend to get the, I'm thinking of Allison at the moment, but you tend to get sort of putting that in perspective against time. And that is really one of the things that brings the parishes and the state to life for me as a reader and as a podcaster. It's multidimensional, I guess, is a way to look at it. And they do a good job of that. I look forward to getting the actual paper quarterly magazine we talked about, but the website itself is not only gorgeous, but is a great source of education. And I would encourage, and we'll certainly put links in the show notes, I'd encourage people to support you guys by subscribing to the magazine. But it's also really neat to go down a rabbit hole. On the website, there's a lot there. There's a lot of articles that go, you know, whether it's about politics. I was recently going down the rabbit hole of former governors or it's race relations.
Right.
You guys had a really interesting article about the Saints and about the Superdome.
Yeah, I mean, I think that drawing folks' attention to the website, 64parishes.org, is important because the magazine, as I said, is quarterly. But the website is actually the umbrella home for not only magazine content, but what used to be called the NOLA or No Louisiana Online Encyclopedia of History and Culture. So we have thousands of entries about Louisiana history and culture, whether it's about Jim Crow in Louisiana or World War II in Louisiana, the history of the Superdome, the history of King Cakes. All of that content is available at 64parishes.org for free. It's very well used by teachers and students across the state. And in fact, during this very strange quarantine time, we learned that the Louisiana Department of Education is including a significant number of 64 parishes articles in these packets that are being sent home for students, because as it turns out, more than a third of Louisiana public school students don't have access to the internet. So we have served as a trusted and reputable source for humanities content that is accessible for over 30 years.
And so that's kind of triggered for us this idea, as you mentioned, during the pandemic and the mix of whatever school's going to look like. You know, we're recording this at the end of July in 2020, but the magazine and then the website are great ways to sort of supplement that and bring our history to life for kids. And just the other day, my kids, longtime listeners, and you know, I have 8-year-old twins. We were talking about their maternal grandmother who is Hungarian. And there is a Hungarian settlement in Livingston Parish. Is that right?
Livingston Parish. That's right. Yeah, we, you know, the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s and 40s did unbelievable documentary work all over the state, capturing communities who are just coming out of the Great Depression, or in some cases are still in the midst of the Great Depression. And we came across this amazing photograph of a citizenship class in Livingston Parish of Hungarian immigrants who were learning English and studying for their citizenship exam, and included it in the last issue of 64 Parishes. It's pretty spectacular.
Yeah. It was fun. So somehow my wife, who is a Tulane grad, knew and had taken her mom there years ago. I'm not sure if there was the little museum then, but I didn't realize it. She had never mentioned it to the kids, and the kids are just becoming avid readers. And so it was a really neat way to connect them with sense of place. They were born in Virginia. Their grandmother lives in Virginia, but they're New Orleanians and Louisianians now. And so, you know, it was fun to see the light bulb go off for them, this connection. And, you know, we could share that with them online in the magazine, but also online, they could look at that.
That's really great. I'll have to let our managing editor know that story. He'll be thrilled.
And the state is just such a wide range. You know, we have densely populated and sparsely populated, and we have a huge forest in a part of the state that people don't think about. You guys recently did an article, Not Our First Rodeo, about the Grand Isle Tarpon Rodeo, I think. Right.
That's right. And unfortunately, you know, that article came out in the summer issue, the Grand Isle Tarpon Rodeo. And just about 2 weeks ago, the organizers canceled the event. They had really held out hope that they'd be able to convene and have the largest event on the island all year. But of course, COVID-19 had other plans. It's an event that draws thousands of people to one of the only remaining barrier islands and the only inhabited barrier island left on Louisiana's coast. And it was just crazy coincidence that we had done that story at the time that we had.
Well, and the reason I thought about it is a couple things, actually. When you were talking about food in northern Louisiana, so you are in tamales over in another part of the state, you had this wide range. Then you go all the way down, although we really aren't shaped like a boot anymore, you go down to what was the bottom of the boot, and you have Grand Isle and part of what gives us the moniker Sportsman's Paradise, right? I think the longest running fishing tournament in the country until now.
That's right.
And it is both still a source of incredible bounty, and at the same time, it's disappearing physically. Grand Isle is probably the parish most, or is part of a parish probably most endangered of disappearing. When you go down to Grand Isle now, it's essentially a road that gets washed over quite regularly, and also brings to light, you guys have done articles periodically and done a lot of work with coastal restoration and the impact that that has not only on our geography, but on our history. You think about something like Grand Isle.
Yeah, one of our primary focuses for the last 4 years has been the environmental humanities, and that is simply a product of the world we are living in Louisiana, where we're losing the equivalent of a football field of land it's not every hour anymore. I think it's every 90 minutes or something like that, but it's a significant amount of land loss. And it's caused a lot of communities to change how they're doing things, to learn how to adapt. And for some parishes like Cameron Parish, which is in the far southwest corner of the state, it's caused extreme depopulation. So you have the parishes north of there, like Allen Parish and Jeff Davis Parish, that are seeing influxes of what are essentially climate refugees, because the land is sinking, the sea level is rising, the shore is eroding and washing away. So you have different settlement patterns that are happening right now in the 21st century. And because we deal with the humanities, we want to understand what the impact is on people's lives and how this is affecting culture and traditions. Our fall issue is the folk life issue. It's our first dedicated folk life issue. And we want to be sure that we document traditions and also understand how they're changing over time.
Well, in that corner of the state, I went to college in Lafayette, and I was there just after the oil bust. And now Lafayette, particularly after Katrina, so many people left New Orleans and went west. And when Baton Rouge filled up, kept going west. And Lafayette is not a sleepy little town anymore. And I think it's a combination of Katrina, as well as all those people that used to live, as you described, south and southwest of Lafayette, still working in the oil field, still having grown up in that very much hunting, trapping area, that's all changing. And those folks are moving north in the city and or north in the state, and sometimes towards Lafayette, sometimes towards Lake Charles, and even into eastern Texas. And that area, I'm glad you brought it up, because at least locally, again, we tend to be very biased. We think and talk a lot about going down river towards Grand Isle and the loss of the wetlands, but it is all along the coast.
Absolutely. Cameron Parish actually has lost more land than any other parish in the state. You talk about the state as a whole has changed. Lafayette has changed tremendously. It's a lovely place. It's much more dynamic than it was 20 years ago. It's much more crowded. There's a lot more development there. They have managed to really figure out how to make that work, I think, in Lafayette. They are what's considered a receiver community. And that's happening. That's a social science term for communities that are impacted by climate migration, for example. Alexandria is another one. There are an awful lot of New Orleanians living in Alexandria. They moved there after Katrina, and many of them stayed. But you've had other communities who have left the coastal areas and moved to receiver communities like Alexandria as well.
And you mentioned that the rate of coastal erosion has slowed, which is great. It's not huge, but there's been an awful lot of work and continues to be. You mentioned the Barrier Islands and trying to figure out how to use technology to recreate Barrier Islands and to slow that erosion. And yet, at the same time, when you were talking about that, I was thinking about, you guys may have done an article, and one I want to do a podcast on, is about the Red River and the getting rid of the 100-year or 1,000-year log jam.
Right, the Red River Raft.
How that directly impacted what we're talking about today with erosion. So we cleared that out so that we could have river traffic from the central part of the country. And in the process, we created this environment that eventually the river is this transport hub. And then we start to try to control the river because of buildup around it. That leads to some of the situations with the erosion. And it just sort of, here we are 300 plus years later.
We exist in Louisiana in a place of great tension, right, between the bounty of our natural resources and industry. So you mentioned oil field workers just a minute ago, and you also mentioned all of these coastal restoration projects. Well, our Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, the CPRA, this is a big statewide agency that is tasked with trying to stop land loss, and in some cases grow land loss. They are funded because of the BP oil spill. So we both rely on the oil and gas industry. That is the reality in our state, is an incredibly important industry. And at the same time, that industry has contributed to some of the widespread problems that we've had with land loss and subsidence, for example. So that tension is always there. I think the Red River example is an excellent illuminating example. That's, you know, you clear the raft so that you can have better navigation, but that has a domino effect and could create other types of challenges. It's like, you know, putting the Mississippi into a fixed channel. They do that for navigation purposes. They do that so that the city of New Orleans is not left high and dry, but it has had great consequences for the communities that may have had a different future had the river been allowed to keep to its natural course.
And, well, and you mentioned the oil industry, and, you know, again, we tend to think of it locally, but so many problems throughout the state, right? With, on the one hand, they provide jobs, and on the other hand, whether it's oil or other fossil fuel type industries, end up disrupting. I think about the communities just north of Lafayette, and, you know, so often the farmlands and the wooded lands, when you see whether it's utilities come through or whatever, maybe they don't always follow what they agreed to do. And then the farmers or the landowners nearby see a difference there. And so it's not just a coastal issue. It really is all throughout our state, the impact of, you know, very much the sort of hand that feeds us also bites us. But you see it manifest in different ways in the state. And again, that's one of the things that I like exploring beyond New Orleans and doing so through the magazine and through the work that you guys do at the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, is that it just brings all that to life in ways that it's easy not to think about sometimes.
Right. And it's complicated. It's not a, this is right, this is wrong. This is complicated. And we have to understand the nuances to better understand some of the decisions that have been made and to understand what the best path forward is.
I find that that is true in so much, maybe of history in general, but certainly in Louisiana, as I think about topics to cover. And it's almost impossible to, you know, you think about any of the bounty in Louisiana or the bounty in New Orleans, and you were quickly drawn to slavery and the impact and the foundation that slavery provided. And so now you look at the grandeur of the Garden District, and yet you have to think about that in terms of so much, if not all of that, was on the basis of slavery. And then you get into other parts of our state where cotton was and still is to a degree a cash crop, and you know that required slave labor. I think that Angola prison is another example. I know you guys did. Angola is fascinating and horrifying, both in terms of the prison, the forced labor, and then we've sort of celebrated the rodeo and the arts and crafts that come from there. And I know prisons and private prisons and using prison labor almost as slave labor is a constant source of tension and income and politics in Louisiana. And I know you guys have covered some of that, but it just sort of seems more relevant now, you know, with where that fits in and what we ought to be considering as a society through today's lens.
Yeah, you know, Louisiana until 2 years ago had the highest rate of incarceration in the United States, which then meant it had the highest rates of incarceration in the world because the United States leads in that category. We are no longer number one. It's Oklahoma. But it's important when we think about the fabric of our society. What does that mean? And where does it come from? What is the relationship between slavery and the mass incarceration of especially people of color in this state? What does it mean that we had a law for over 100 years that allowed juries to convict individuals without being unanimous? Well, it doesn't take a lot of work to understand where that legislation came from. It came out of the backlash against Reconstruction. And we were one of the only states in the country that allowed that to happen, where you could have someone convicted without the jury fully agreeing that that person was guilty. So when you look at the history of Angola, that's a perfect example of the depth of the challenges that we face in the 21st century, understanding the precedents and how they're related to things like convict lease systems and forced labor and of course, slavery.
Yeah, and I bring it up because, as you point out, it's complicated. And it is also, I think, maybe a lot of people not from here don't know about Angola or don't know or maybe think they know something. Maybe I've heard of the rodeo or maybe I've heard of Sister Helen Prejean and the book and the movie Dead Man Walking. There's a lot of layers there. Aaron, I think that's what I wanted to get across to people, that 64 parishes, maybe like a lot of states, our 64 parishes are pretty varied, and there's a lot to see and do and a lot to learn. And especially now where we can't get out and travel and we can't get out and experience things as much as we did, for people that are interested in sort of exploring virtually, there's a ton to learn. I certainly think your magazine is a great jumping off point, and the website's reinforcing of that. But it also causes people that are interested to then explore further on their own, right? Those topics. Plenty of the authors and writers you mentioned have numerous works of their own. And so if our listeners hear or see something that's of interest, they can dive down both through the topic and through that author or that writer. I also, you mentioned that the publication is 4 times a year, and people can sign up to support and to subscribe at 64parishes.org, right?
That's right, 64parishes.org/subscribe. And the next issue, the Fall Folklife issue, lands on September 1st. And if you are interested in getting that issue in your mailbox during quarantine, you need to subscribe by August 5th, because we have these crazy things called print deadlines, and they are real.
Erin, I just want to thank you for taking the time to share a little bit about what you guys do, but also about the variety of our state.
You're very welcome.
We will share it. And again, the reason I thought it was timely is it's a great way. I think that people can be home and be frustrated, which is all fair, and we're all doing that. But this is a great opportunity to use the resources and the experts and engage your mind and get to sort of explore virtually. And I think you all helped do that. I love, and you know that, the rebranding of the magazine and the website. I also like, we didn't really talk about it, but I know you said you guys did research and put a real emphasis into not just looking at New Orleans and how many articles have been done about various parts of the state. And you've made a real conscious effort to address that, if you will.
That's right. You know, as the statewide organization, Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, we thought it was critical that we speak to people's experiences across the state. New Orleans is great. We still do a lot of New Orleans stories, but the rest of the state has interesting stories to tell as well.
Yeah. And for me, it's just a way of getting to know sort of sense of place, right? Beyond New Orleans is sort of famous for people don't leave their neighborhoods ever. You know, and there are 63 other parishes here full of all kinds of interesting things. So thanks once again. I appreciate it. I'll put links in the show notes, which will be over at beyondbourbonst.com/117 to LEH and 64 parishes. You can also find discount codes from our sponsors and partners over there, as well as information on how to become a Patreon supporter. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.